Panvira knew how deeply Sam was disturbed by Kane, by the very fact he still lived, despite forswearing allegiance to him. He was a man who had defeated the Barons on numerous occasions, and who merited death for all the chaos he had wrought, but who had, incredibly, managed to elude the traps set for him, the snares designed to hold him fast.
He has been lucky.
Luck? Or something more? An attribute as unusual as his physical prowess. We know the nature of the human mind. We know that the squids enable my mind to become the mind of the human, old or new, in almost total assimilation. But only of those born in the last 20 or so years. Kane and his friends were of a very specific mindset. Headstrong, brilliant, even domineering. They filled an important niche before, when the planet was struggling to recover from the nuclear holocaust, but they became obsolete. Nature abhors more than a vacuum. It also abhors and eliminates evolutionary dead ends. I helped nature along, even prodded her when circumstances required it. I should have devoted more time to neutralizing even the potential for a threat.
You had other things to do. Implementing the Great Plan was far more important than dealing with a couple of malcontents with deficient comprehension abilities.
Now you must supply my own deficiencies, Scorpia Prime. You must make sure that his foolish tamperings with the quantum field do not impinge on my... our work. It has reached a critical juncture, and will not abide the kind of interference that Kane and Grant were renowned for employing when they were younger.
There are just two of them, and it appears that the wedge driven between them years ago is still intact. Singly, they can do nothing. Even together, they would only be a nuisance. It would not be like the days when this place, this Cerberus, was a focal point of destructive energy, when the world was full of unbridled savagery, of killing, of torture, and hatred.
Perhaps. Only Kane and Grant remain of those chaotic days. Nature no longer has any use for them, except where and how they may serve others. But as long as one of them exists, they are an energy focus.
I do not understand.
The universe is a violent maelstrom of energy, of forces that could ravage this world flow just outside our boundaries of perception. But those forces are only destructive when interference is created. And if nothing else, Kane and Grant are creatures of interference. I believe it is ingrained, perhaps even in their DNA. The stronger must survive, and those two men are the ultimate survivors. But they have outsurvived their time. There is no place for them here.
For the Imperator, the words and emotions he had just conveyed were the equivalent of not only baring his soul, but also a lengthy statement of policy. She felt her heartbeat speed up due to the course of action the Imperator implied.
They have been controlled for 2 decades or more. Through personal loss, confusion, and manipulation, they have posed no threat to you or the Great Plan.
Plans are brittle, great or otherwise. And like glass, they can shatter if the proper force is applied in just the right place. There are times when events shoulder aside and ride roughshod over the most intricately constructed plans. Our work is a very delicate balancing act to bring together powerful forces and events so they will create what the world needs so desperately.
The Tandava? The time of Pralya?
Do you think I will employ excessive force to solve this problem? That it is a demonstration of misplaced and lingering resentment toward those two men who fought with me but not for me?
Not at all. I only suggest that to divert resources to neutralizing Kane and Grant might be a waste of potential energy.
Perhaps so. But would you not agree that any loss would be minimized against the greater gain?
Tanvira recognized the trap. To question him further or to disagree was to betray a weakness. If she challenged him, no matter how diplomatically, then she would be classified as a dreamer, an idealist. She would be denounced as one who could not abide efficiency and applied logic. She would stand with Kane, with Grant, with all those who were the natural enemies of the Imperator. Once they had been eliminated, the rest of the populace would be relatively easy to control. Or at least that was the common philosophy as espoused by her parents. She knew Sam was as close to a genuine messiah as was ever born in the history of the world. She also knew that such messianic claims were usually based on prophecies recorded earlier in history, and there was only one sure way of separating a pretender from a true messiah. The title had to be earned by deed, not by word. It was a cold and uncompromising way of looking at it, since it ruthlessly stripped away the facade of magic and mystery and forced whoever claimed the title of Messiah to actually bring about prophesied changes. Sam could do that, and he had been doing so, but only because he brooked no interference from those who didn't share his vision or his lofty goals of a unified world.
I follow you, brother. No matter where you lead or what path you direct me to walk.
The answer satisfied Sam, at least for the time being.
Then gain Cain's confidence. It is unimportant how we do it, but I must know his plans.
And you shall, by any means at my disposal.
And there the communication ended, which was fortunate because the notion of how the means always shaped the ends had crept into the forefront of her mind. The night breeze suddenly carried with it the rich whiff of burning tobacco, and Tanvira turned swiftly. She saw Cain standing no more than 10 feet away, the tip of a cigar glowing like a red cyclopean eye in the shadows of his face. Chagrined, she realized he had crossed the plateau without a misstep or making a noise. He looked like a shadow, dressed in form-fitting black.
"You need to be careful walking out here. One wrong step, and all the Imperator's soldiers and all the Imperator's ass-kissers won't be able to put you back together again."
Tanvira didn't care for his tone or demeanor. She was disturbed more than angered, however.
"I looked for you earlier."
"I just got back a few minutes ago. Bri told me you were taking an evening constitutional."
"It's beautiful out here. I've always loved the night. It hides all the dirt and ugliness and suffering, and covers it with mystery and the promise of hope for a new day. My mother and I used to take walks on the walls of High River. All the bright lights of the city, the smells, everything seemed wonderful."
"When it was called Koboldville, all you could smell was the Tartarus pits, and that sure as hell didn't smell wonderful."
Tanvira brushed strands of hair from her face.
"You're a cynical man, Cain. Were you always this way?"
Removing the cigar from his mouth, he blew a plume of smoke toward the sky. He presented the image of seriously pondering the question.
"Pretty much, yeah."
"My father has said that those who live the most restricted lives are often the most intolerant. And I suppose there are few lives as restricted as the one you and Bri have been living up here."
"I still get around. For example, I just made a trip out to the coast."
"To where?"
"Where you wanted me to go. Ikazuchi Kojima."
"Where?"
She knew exactly what he meant, and she involuntarily hugged herself.
"Thunder Isle."
Tanvira didn't reply, but she turned slightly away from him, gazing up at the sky. Her profile was sharp against the moonlight, the smooth mounds of her breasts enhanced by the wind-tautened fabric. The long, smooth curves of her thighs were parted, and the material of her robe formed a concavity between them.
"Must we talk about that again? Let's just enjoy the night and each other's company."
"You're wasting your time, Tanvira. You're certainly beautiful, but I'm not aroused by tools, by walking, talking, performing instruments."
She knew she should have felt rage at his words, but instead she experienced only a wave of sadness, so soul-deep that she could barely keep a sob from catching at her throat.
"No, not you, Cain."
She turned to face him, one hand lifting to press against his chest.
"Never you. A man who has been hurt by loss, and then adjudges all the world responsible for his pain. You have fire still in you, but not warmth."
He said nothing, but he met her gaze stolidly. With a distant sense of shock, Tanvira realized he was indeed the ultimate survivor, a creature of the wild, perhaps the most dangerous creature in the world. She understood why Sam resented him so. Cain was a man who had learned early to live without any protection other than that provided by his own prowess and wits. Unlike Sam, she admired his survivability. A warrior, one not afraid to kill, an explorer, one never afraid to plunge into the unknown, a peacemaker, one compassionate enough to extend the hand of friendship to a defeated enemy. Compared to him, despite his staggering intellect, Sam seemed a petulant, fearful child. Tanvira removed her hand from his chest, but she continued to gaze searchingly into Cain's pale eyes.
Tanvira, I hope you're not expecting me to break into tears because you've touched my heart and I'm desperate to unburden myself to someone, particularly a woman.
She shook her head in pity.
I'm not expecting anything, Cain. Except maybe for you to tell me when I can go home. Since you gated to Thunder Isle, you must have reconfigured the Matrans for normal use.
Cain examined the wet end of the cigar before putting it back in his mouth.
True, but Bri is right now reconfiguring it again, back to the spatio-temporal dissociator settings.
Fear leaped through her, galvanized her.
What? Why?
You know why. Your mother, your father, and Sam know why. So I can start to undo all of their perfect orchestrations of people, power, governments, and more important, time.
She struggled to tamp down her rising terror.
You don't know what you're doing, Cain. You power that thing up without the preset reference conformals and...
She bit back her words when she saw him angle ironic eyebrows at her. He grinned around the cigar, but it wasn't an expression of amusement as much as one of triumph.
So, you do know a bit more about the functioning principles of the dissociator than you let on. Why am I not surprised? But I am surprised that Lakesh would agree to have his daughter act as the Imperator's whore to fuck information out of me.
Tanvira's lips peeled back in a snarl. She lunged at Cain, swinging her fist at his face.
Bastard!
Cain only leaned back a bit and easily caught her wrist. Spinning her around, he jerked her arm up between her shoulder blades in a hammerlock.
Let me go!
Just a second, kid.
With his free hand, he patted her down. And for an instant, Tanvira wondered if Cain had lost what was left of his mind and was groping her as a way of destroying her dignity. When she felt his hand slide into the pockets of her robe, she began struggling in a panic.
Stop!
Removing his hand from her right pocket, Cain pushed her away from him and released his grip on her wrist. Tanvira whirled and saw him twirling the Uma pendant by its silver chain. She snatched at it frantically, but he evaded her reach, allowing it to wrap around his hand with the diamond nestled snugly in his palm. Tanvira lunged for him, fingers seeking his eyes. Cain planted a hand on her forehead and pushed her away. She sat down heavily on the tarmac. Cain stepped away from her, his face momentarily clouded by a wreath of smoke. He turned his head and spit the stub out of his mouth.
Like your old man said, I only pretend to be stupid. Don't you think I knew about the Uma stones, how they're used as forms of communication between the squid implants and Sam? I was pretty sure you had one on you since you were acting as his ambassador. Just like I'm sure you've already reported to him. That's why I don't have the luxury of performing further experiments.
Tanvira started to push herself to her feet.
Stay there or I'll kick you ass first off the cliff. What did you tell Sam?
Nothing. I had nothing to tell him.
Cain grinned coldly, showing only the edges of his teeth.
Let me guess, then. You told him how I was half-fused out, tinkering around with my time machine and drooling in my beard, all heartbroken, forlorn, and desperate for a cause, an enemy to fight. The story of the Naroda and the return of the Scorpia Prime was just the thing, offering me another menace to go after and maybe getting a little revenge for the death of Brigid.
Tanvira didn't reply, but she knew her expression had to have betrayed her feelings.
I thought so. And he told you to ease my suffering and in the process find out just exactly what my plans are with the dissociator. After that, did he order you to kill me? Or did he hope that would happen if I trespassed on Thunder Isle?
She blinked up at him in confusion. Neither possibility had occurred to her.
You're the strategist, you tell me.
He took a step forward, extending a hand to her.
I'll do better than that. I'll show you.
Tanvira recoiled at first, thinking he meant to strike her. Then she stared at his hand suspiciously, distrustfully, as if the black-gloved fingers were really venomous serpents. Then she reached up and took it. Kane easily pulled her to her feet.
Show me what?
He marched toward the sector, striding with a long-legged purposefulness. She hurried to catch up. When they entered the main corridor, she was instantly aware of a high-pitched hum, a distant vibration emanating from the operation center. Her belly turned cold.
What are you doing, Kane?
Bri is powering up the dissociator.
He wended his way through the debris in the passageway, and Tanvira rushed after him, scraping her knees and bumping her elbows.
You can't use it! You can't change the present in the past. Time ripples away from an event horizon and flattens out at the edge. So that'll leave you hanging in a paradox that time itself will have to resolve.
He ignored her. He marched through the operations center and into the antechamber holding the gateway unit. She dogged his heels, still babbling. The door of the jump chamber was sealed, but from within flared a constellation of sparks, blurred and smeared due to the translucent quality of the armor glass. From the elevated platform, a nerve-stinging hum wafted. Bri sat inside the curve of the crescent-shaped console.
The data cards are uploaded. Retrieval process engaged.
Tandura's verbal onslaught of scientific principle clogged in her throat. She swiveled her head so swiftly toward Kane, her neck tendons twinged in pain.
Retrieval process?
Kane nodded, gesturing to the gateway unit.
You, your parents, and Sam were all wrong about my plans. I wasn't trying to build a dissociator to go back in time myself, but to pull someone out of non-time, zero time. For the past 28 years, he's been in the Operation Kronos memory buffer matrix, reduced to digital information. He's been outside space-time for all those years, more or less in a state of non-existence. It's not too different from a gateway's quincunx effect, which I'm sure your old man has explained to you.
That's impossible! Nobody could exist outside time!
You apparently never had Operation Kronos' temporal dilator explained to you. In certain circumstances, photons, the particles of which light is made, can jump between two points separated by a barrier and freeze in what appears to be zero time. That's where our subject has been for nearly 30 years, in a holding pattern.
Who? Who has been in zero time?
On the other side of the armor glass walls, great blossoming splashes of color filled the gateway unit. The whine climbed higher in pitch to such a painful volume everyone covered their ears. All of them stared wide-eyed at the mat-traps. Faintly, at first, as through rolling, multicolored clouds, a shape began to materialize, surrounded by an iridescent halo of white mist shot through with coruscating particles of brilliance, like a fireworks display as seen from a vast distance. The multicolored clouds overlapped. Sparks that were more energy than light flashed on the other side of the armor glass slabs. The air around the gateway unit wavered with a shimmery blur like heat waves rising off sun-baked asphalt. Then a bone-jarring crack of thunder compressed their eardrums, hammered at the marrow of their bones. A deafening, concussive blast cannonaded from within the enclosed jump chamber. The door sprang open as if kicked violently from within. Kane pulled Tandura back as a torrent of dazzling white flame and variegated lightning strokes blazed out of the unit. Crooked fingers of energy continued to boil and hiss and flare inside the gateway unit, forming a catch cradle of red crackling threads. Gushing lines of energy formed a luminous cloud in the center of the cradle and then burst apart in a blizzard of sparks. Amid the glowing plasma splinters, a small body plummeted out of the heart of the cloud and fell heavily to the floor. The body appeared to have been dipped in jet-black dye from the neck down. After a second, Tanvira realized the figure wore the same kind of form-fitting bodysuit as Kane. The three of them watched in shocked silence as the small figure of a man pushed himself to all fours on trembling arms and shaking legs. Sindri looked around unfocusedly, then lowered his head and vomited. Sindri tried to shift position away from the pool of vomit, but in doing so, he fell onto his right side, his limbs twitching spasmodically. His eyes were tightly closed, and foam flecked his lips, oozing from the corners of his mouth.
He's seizing!
Kane went to him instantly, dropping to his knees beside the little man. He lowered his head to his chest.
Irregular heartbeat.
Kane heaved him up effortlessly, and holding the 3-foot-plus man in his arms like a child, rushed out of the operations center.
Tanvira, you've got medical training. Come with me.
The note of command was so powerful in his voice, Tanvira didn't realize she had obeyed him until she was halfway out of the control complex. She continued after Kane, her mind spinning with questions, anxieties, and outright fears.
Who is that man? Where did he come from?
His name is Sindri. Originally, he came from Mars.
Mars? You didn't materialize him from Mars!
Kane entered the infirmary and laid the little man on the nearest examination bed.
I pulled him from the Operation Kronos memory buffer, where subjects who had been trawled from the past were stored as digital patterns. He jumped into the temporal dilator almost 30 years ago, and he's been locked in zero time ever since. Give me a hand here.
Tanvira moved to the bedside, looking down at the man who resembled a child lying in his parents' bed. Although he appeared to be only 3.5 feet tall, his perfect proportions confused her sense of perspective for a moment. Unlike other dwarves she had seen, his legs weren't stumpy, or his arms too long, or his head too big. But she couldn't help notice the impressive size of the bulge outlined by the dark black fabric at the juncture of his thighs. His dark blonde hair was swept back from an unusually high forehead and tied in a ponytail at his nape. He was ashen, with a mixture of bile and saliva dripping from the corners of his mouth, but he was still one of the most handsome men she had ever seen. Kane opened Sindri's bodysuit by releasing a seal on the right side and roughly peeling it down over his torso, revealing a broad chest with a down-like covering of hair. Kane turned, took a bag from a shelf, and removed a stethoscope. He listened to Sindri's heart, took his pulse, and examined his eyes, moving from one task to the other with a grim, brisk efficiency.
We've got auricular fibrillation.
Do you have any supplies of digitalis or guanidine? Or a defibrillator?
Shaking his head, Kane reached into the medical bag again.
No, but I prepared for this a long time ago.
He removed a hypodermic syringe with a frighteningly long needle. It was filled with a faintly amber liquid. Tanvira grimaced.
What is that?
Adrenaline. Hold him down.
Tanvira did as he said. Kane jammed the needle into Sindri's chest, and there was a faint crunch of gristle as the needle penetrated the chest cavity. Sindri didn't react to the sensation, but when Kane emptied the syringe's contents into his heart, he gave out a loud, gargling cry and tried to jackknife up from the bed. His legs kicked madly, as if he were running in place. His back arched as if he had received a kick between the shoulder blades. Then the little man fell back onto the bed. Tanvira released him, looking down into his sweat-sheened face.
I don't think he's breathing.
The little pissant is breathing, all right.
Kane removed the hypodermic. A little pinpoint of blood shone on his skin. Sindri's chest rose and fell. His hands and feet stirred, and then the stirrings became movement. Finally, his eyes, which had been tightly closed, fluttered and opened. They were glassy, but a clear, clean azure. He looked around vacantly, his mouth open. His eyes held no recognition of the man or woman leaning over him.
Welcome back to the world. It's not any richer for having you back in it, but maybe you'll be able to change that.
Sindri's blue eyes contained a dim, conscious spark, but they were still glazed and unfocused. His lips writhed, and reedy sounds neither Tanvira nor Kane could identify whispered out. Kane slapped Sindri across the face, once, twice, three times. They weren't gentle attention-getting slaps. The infirmary echoed with a loud smack of his gloved hand striking flesh. Sindri's head rolled and wobbled on his neck.
Get it together, goddamn you. You're not going to be brain damaged after all the trouble and time I've spent retrieving your slagging ass. Get it together!
Tanvira reached across Sindri to grab Kane's hand to keep him from striking the little man again.
Stop it! He'll either come around on his own or he won't. Hitting him like that will only...
Kane gaped at Tanvira as she bounded away from the bed.
The little pervert grabbed me!
All tension drained out of Kane as he leaned over Sindri, hands on either side of the small man's shoulders. The dwarf blinked up at him blearily, a crooked grin creasing his lips.
Did I dream those boobs? I hope not.
Kane decided not to answer that particular question.
Do you know who you are?
A glint of the man's old characteristic arrogance showed in his eyes.
Of course I do. But I don't know who the hell you are.
Take a good guess, Sindri.
Sindri squinted up at him, his forehead wrinkling in concentration. His eyes flicked back and forth. Then his face became a slack mask of shock.
It can't be.
Oh, but I assure you, it be. It very much be. You thought you'd escaped from me, didn't you? It took me damn near 30 years, but I have you again.
While Sindri stared at him in disbelief, Kane swiftly applied the bed's restraining straps to the man's ankles and wrists. By the time he had recovered somewhat from his astonishment, he was securely affixed to the bed.
Mr. Kane?
The same.
Good God! What happened to you?
About 3 decades of hard living, Sindri, which you were fortunate enough to miss out on. But I'll guarantee, if you don't cooperate with me, I'll make your next 30 days a hell of a lot worse than the 30 years I went through.
Kane walked toward the adjacent laboratory.
I'll get you some water.
Tanvira stared at Sindri, who stared back. Then she joined Kane in the laboratory. He stood at a sink, filling a pitcher with water from a faucet.
Who is that man?
You mean your father never told you about Sindri?
She shook her head. A smirk lifted the corner of Kane's mouth.
I guess I shouldn't be surprised. He was the only other man in the world who was able to figure out the workings of the Mattrans units and overcome all of Lakesh's security settings.
That doesn't answer my question.
Have you ever heard the old saying about hate being as strong a bond as love?
No.
There's a bond of hate between me and the little man in there. The hate he feels towards me made him the most vicious enemy I ever faced, and that's saying something. But as sick as it sounds, that hate links us in an intimate way. I'm putting all of my faith and dreams and aspirations of the last 28 years into his little baby hands.
Tanvira frowned, nibbled nervously on her underlip.
Tell me about him.
30 years before, while exploring an anomaly in the Cerberus network of functioning gateway units, Lakesh, Bridget, and Kane visited Redoubt Papa near Washington Hole. They found the body of a strange, stunted, troll-like man and returned with it to Cerberus. After a post-mortem, the troll was found not to be a mutant or a hybrid, but a human being modified to live in an environment with a rarefied atmosphere and low gravity. After a bit of investigation and a process of elimination, Lakesh traced the quantum conduit used by the Transadapt to jump into Redoubt Papa to a point in outer space, a pre-dark space station on the far side of the moon known as Parallax Red. Kane, Grant, and Bridget gated to it, finding the station functional, if not exactly comfortable. It was populated by the group of stunted people known as Transadapts, and led by an ingenious gnome of a man calling himself Sindri, after the master forger of the troll race in Norse mythology. Sindri impressed them all with his wit, his charm, his probing intellect, and his affected manner. They were particularly impressed by the startling story he told about Parallax Red and its connection to a human colony on Mars. They later encountered Sindri on Thunder Isle, where he had commandeered the Operation Kronos facility. There, his experiments with the temporal dilator had saved Domi's life. When the dilator reached critical mass, Kane had assumed Sindri had gated back to Parallax Red. After the passage of many years, with no sign of him, Kane began to suspect Sindri had met an altogether different fate. Unable to use the Mattrans unit to escape the installation, he had instead used the machinery to digitize himself, so his energy pattern was stored in the dilator's memory buffer. As far as Sindri's perceptions were concerned, he had made the rash decision to expose himself to the dilator's chronon radiation less than a minute before. As far as Kane was concerned, Sindri had managed to duck out on 30 years of war, terror, and hardship. He looked forward to giving the little man a crash course in history. He expected Sindri to extend himself to change it, even if it meant killing him. Especially if it meant killing him. Kane knew Sindri wouldn't take long to orient himself to his new circumstances and start scheming how he could affect them to serve himself. He was a true survivor and exceptionally adaptable. Moreover, the little man saw his purpose in life as an integral part of the flow of the universe, so the very idea he couldn't be involved in it was inconceivable. He also believed his very existence served as a force for social change, and therefore that made him pretty much a law unto himself. In the past, Sindri's vision of himself had brought him into conflict with Kane and his friends. They tried to impose a degree of order on chaos. Therefore, he was chosen by fate to be an agent of anarchy. He never would have admitted such a thing, however. He would have referred to it as working to achieve a state of equilibrium. Now, Kane intended to persuade him that the universe was seriously unbalanced, and only he could set it right again. And that meant doing what Kane told him to do. Due to the method by which he was retrieved from the pattern buffer matrix, Sindri was physically weak and his mental faculties less than razor keen. By using the dissociator rather than the temporal dilator to snatch Sindri from zero time, Kane had circumvented hundreds of built-in security and safety protocols. Bry had warned him on more than one occasion that by jury-rigging the dissociator's hardware to accommodate the dilator's software, and then to engage the gateway's energy-to-matter conversion process, might initiate an irreparable breach in the quantum field. That was the worst-case scenario. The best case was that Sindri might reconstitute as 3 feet worth of shapeless protoplasm and powdered calcium. Kane had never doubted for a second it was worth the risk. As far as he was concerned, if the worst and best cases occurred, it was a win-win. However, judging by Sindri's lassitude, the latter outcome might have only been narrowly avoided. After a few minutes of lying quietly in restraints and drinking the water from a cup held by Tanvira, who kept her face averted from his hungry eyes, Sindri finally felt confident enough to start making demands.
"Mr. Kane, you are not going to introduce me to my dusky female attendant?"
"Tanvira, this is Sindri."
Sindri smiled up at her ingenuously.
"Tanvira, a lovely name, evoking imagery of sultry jungles and the palace of King Solomon."
He paused, his smile broadening.
"And when the Queen of Sheba had seen all Solomon's wisdom, there was no more spirit in her. How is your spirit faring, gorgeous?"
Tanvira's expression was stony.
"My father hath chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions."
She swept Kane with a quick glare, then veiled her dark eyes with her lashes. If she hoped Kane would outwardly display a sign that he found her, quote, significant, she was disappointed. He pretended not to have heard her. However, Sindri's blue eyes widened with genuine surprise.
"Mr. Kane, regardless of all your other faults, and they are legion, your taste in female companionship is always without peer. Like Miss Bridget and Captain Shizuka, with whom I was briefly acquainted, Tanvira is equally witty, knowledgeable, and beautiful to a fault."
"King Solomon loved many strange women."
Tanvira swung her head toward him, eyes glinting briefly with suspicion. Sindri regarded Kane with a mixture of surprise and resentment.
"Despite the 3 decades of hard living you alluded to, you evidently found time to further your education."
Kane shrugged.
"Not a hell of a lot to do up here on long winter nights except to read."
Sindri eyed Tanvira slyly.
"I think, with such a companion, I could come up with a pastime far more entertaining than memorizing the Bible."
Tanvira looked as if she were going to spit at the little man bound to the bed. Then she speared Kane with a stare of pure venom, spun on her heel, and stalked away.
"Oh, come back, little Sheba. Don't be so sensitive. I was complimenting you."
He turned pleading eyes toward Kane.
"Please smooth things over. Tell her I meant no offense to a gracious and lovely hostess."
"She's just a guest, Sindri, like you. She's only been here since this morning. But if not for her, you might not be lying there right now, able to play the mini-lech."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean she more or less inspired me to move on a plan I've had in the works for many years."
"What plan is that?"
"To retrieve you from the temporal dilator's memory buffer."
Sindri smirked contemptuously.
"Are you telling me her soulful eyes melted your heart as to my incorporeal plight?"
Kane stood up from the stool, shaking his head.
"I'm telling you the exact opposite. I think the Imperator has a way of monitoring what I was doing with my own version of the dilator, and somehow figured out what I had in mind."
"Who the hell is the Imperator?"
"Somebody who, by all rights, should be your role model. But right now, if he finds out I've hooked and landed you from zero time, he'll be wanting to fillet you alive."
Blowing out an exasperated sigh, Sindri fixed his eyes on the ceiling and strained briefly against the canvas straps holding him to the bed.
"Mr. Kane, in any enterprise, there is a point where a wise man accepts his limitations."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning, I have no idea of whom or what you're speaking.
Therefore, I see no profit in continuing to verbally spar with you or flirt with the girls. You definitely have me at a disadvantage in just about every way conceivable. I can't even be sure if you are you.
I'm impressed, Sindri. You reached that conclusion in half the time I expected you to. So we can talk now without either one of us resorting to threats or boasts or bullshit?
Sindri removed his gaze from the ceiling and gave Kane a slow, speculative stare.
I'm the one who's impressed, Mr. Kane. You are displaying a degree of mental acuity and depth of emotion I didn't think was possible for you. That's why I harbor a bit of doubt as to your actual identity.
Kane frowned at him. The old smugness, the old superiority was creeping back into Sindri's tone and manner, and it made Kane impatient.
It really is me, Sindri. And it really is you. Two old friends reunited at last.
Sindri's handsome face registered apprehension at the grim, almost fatalistic note underscoring Kane's voice, but he said nothing.
You and I are going to have a long talk, Sindri. At the end of it, I'm going to present you with a proposal. Depending on your answer, this very well may be your last measurable hour on Earth. Your own zero hour, so to speak. So?
He began unbuckling the restraints, enjoying Sindri's startled expression.
I'll arrange it so you spend that last hour as a free man. Or at least as free as you can be on the Imperator's adaptive Earth.
Using clear, concise language, without trying to dramatize or minimize, Kane related everything that had happened in the world, and to him, since he and Sindri had last seen each other. Kane told him about the rise of Sam and the so-called Imperator War, which had actually happened a few months before he and his friends encountered Sindri on Thunder Isle. He told him about how Baron Cobalt, thought dead for many months, had secretly enlisted the aid of several disaffected members of the baronial oligarchy. Since they were autocratic by birth and treacherous by nature, they formed a covert alliance to break the influence of the Imperator. The war that followed, the Consolidation War, lasted for nearly 5 years. Early on, the Baron scored a string of impressive victories, occupying several vills with troopers conscripted and recruited from the slums of the fortress cities and outland pest holes. Atrocities became commonplace, wherever baronial armies marched or encamped. However, Baron Cobalt's policy of merciless cruelty boomeranged against him. Instead of breaking the spirit of the conquered outlanders, it only fired resistance, particularly when people knew there was a viable alternative to baronial rule. Many of the hybrids who shared the Archon-derived DNA of the Barons joined Imperial forces, although most of them made very poor soldiers due to their physical fragility. To offset this deficiency, Sam saw to the creation of genetically engineered warriors, the Pishchakas. They augmented the Imperial armies. Part of Kane's duties was to go into the Outlands and recruit people there, if not making them official soldiers in Sam's armed forces, at least convincing them to become guerrilla fighters. The ones who refused to take sides were neutralized. Over the course of the war, the entire system of baronial rule withered from within and without. More and more outland territories split away from the direct influence of the Barons. By the time the Imperator claimed those territories, the Baronies lacked the former strength in unity that had once enabled them to hold firm against all threats. The end, when it came, was swift. All the surviving Barons were killed, either in battles or by execution. The Consolidated Confederation of States was formed shortly thereafter. Victory, although absolute, was not celebrated for very long, due to the revolts of the Pishchakas. They were created to wage war against baronial forces. With those forces defeated, they turned on their creators. Shortly after the worst of that threat was ended, the Naroda movement extended its claws across the seas to latch on to like-minded fanatics in America. As a method of ensuring that menaces from within the body politic would be minimized, Sam ordered that every citizen of the CCS would be required to have squid implants. During the last several years of the Consolidation War, the implants were mandatory for new recruits. Now, even infants born within the direct sphere of influence of the CCS cities were implanted with the devices. By the time Sam instituted this policy, the Consolidated Confederacy of States was completely entrenched as the form of government, far more securely rooted than the God-King system practiced by the Barons. With every citizen now linked by the neuronic energy of the squids, old and new humans alike lived in harmony. Sam announced his intention to build a new world, an adaptive Earth, as he called it. He described it as a world where everyone had an important niche to fill. Therefore, they would be able to adapt to any changes or new set of circumstances that might arise, confident they could deal with it efficiently. Now, 20 years after the fact, the citizenry of the CCS were so accustomed to obeying the edicts of imperial law that any question, much less opposition, was unthinkable. From babyhood, they were indoctrinated to serve the universal good of imperial law. It was a world of peace, of modern cities that were connected by monorail tunnels, where hell zones had been remade into Eden-like parks. The ruins of nuke-scarred cities were torn down and playgrounds were built in their place. Human and hybrid, once bitter enemies, each perceived the other much like the Cro-Magnon had looked at the Neanderthal. Now they coexisted, even married. They had adapted. Sam envisioned transforming Earth into a garden of beauty and knowledge, but only if the planet's inhabitants could adapt to his vision. Sindri rubbed his forehead.
Sounds ideal.
Too ideal.
Nothing can be too ideal.
It can when you make everything so easy for a human that he loses his instincts, his independence, his ability to effect change on his own.
This whole story is not easy to accept.
Think how I feel, and I lived it.
Sitting on the edge of the bed, his legs dangling, Sindri regarded Kane with a lopsided grin.
In all my dreams of punishing you, Mr. Kane, what you just told me of your suffering makes them seem like petty little resentments.
Good. Then you don't have any reason to waste time trying to get revenge on me for past defeats, and we can move on.
Sindri cocked his head at a quizzical angle.
Move on to what?
To start undoing the events I just described. To make sure they never come to pass.
And how do you figure to do that? With the temporal dilator at the Operation Kronos facility?
No, that's wrecked. Brigid caused it to hit critical mass, remember?
Of course I do. To me, it happened only an hour or so ago. You let me go in the hopes I could disengage the chain reaction. I was able to, just barely. However, I knew there would be a venting of energies of the subatomic particle stream, so I jumped into the memory buffer matrix to save myself.
It took me a while, but I figured out that's what you did.
A while? It took you over 20 years.
Kane's eyes glinted hard with anger.
But I'm grateful nevertheless.
You should be. Because now you'll have a chance to actually contribute something worthwhile to the world, rather than take from it.
Sindri crossed his right leg over the other and cupped the knee.
Beyond the fact you've threatened to kill me if I don't cooperate, why shouldn't I try to introduce myself to this imperator of yours and hook up with him, strike an alliance? From what you've told me, it sounds like he and I have similar attitudes, particularly in regards to you.
Kane folded his arms over his chest and smiled without humor.
Because he would see your attitude as a threat to his own. There's room for only one imperator, and he'd definitely think you'd be trying to steal his crown. And, of course, you would.
True enough.
Besides, even if you escaped from this place, it's not like the wild old days when you had free rein to try and carve out your own little piece of empire someplace. Your helper monkeys, the Transadapts, are most likely all dead by now, since you told me their lifespans were around 30 years. And the few who might survive, either on Mars or Parallax Red, would barely remember you. They sure as hell wouldn't obey you. So there go any potential followers.
The frown tugging at Sindri's mouth deepened.
About the only halfway organized bunch that you could maybe persuade to follow you would be the Pishchakas. But in my opinion, they'd be having you for lunch before you finished your first recruitment speech. Yeah, it'll be pretty damn hard to reestablish yourself as a messiah, a conqueror, or simply as a plain old criminal mastermind on the Imperator's adaptive Earth. He's just about got a monopoly on all your old vocations.
I see your point, Mr. Kane. What's your proposition?
It's pretty simple, actually. I've built a machine called a spatio-temporal dissociator.
You built?
It's linked to the auto-sequencers of the Mattrans Gateway unit here. With the data cards I took from the temporal dilator, we can transmit a channel through the quantum stream and focus an injection point in a particular time and place. In this case, the time is 27 years ago. The place is here, Redoubt Cerberus, and our gateway unit.
Sindri's lips pursed as he considered Kane's words.
I thought old Lakesh had set up a security lock on the system.
He had. You overcame it before. You can do it again.
True. But what kind of tests have you conducted? How do you know this will work?
I really don't know if it'll work at all. We only attempted one test about a week ago. We tried to send an old coin through, but we weren't successful.
Did the coin come back whole?
Actually, no. It reassembled as its constituent parts, like little metal and alloy particles.
Then how the hell do you...
Kane raised a peremptory hand.
I'm not done. I have a vague recollection of a particular day 27 years ago, when an unauthorized carrier wave activated the gateway. It lasted only a minute, and nobody could figure it out. Brian Lakesh just wrote it off as some sort of electromagnetic interference, a glitch in the network.
How do you know that's not exactly what it was?
I don't. But inasmuch as you're the only man I know who has been out of the time stream for the required 27-plus years, that makes you the only man perfectly suited to find out if the dissociator works or not.
Lucky me.
You've been given a singular honor, Sindri. You can finally undertake an action that might justify your existence. And the best part of it is you'll also be doing it for a selfish reason. If you survive the trip, you'll be back in your own time period, free from the memory buffer and able to implement your own dreams of empire again. We'll be back at each other's throats just like nothing ever happened. Bridget will be alive for you to try to seduce. You can attempt to take Thunder Isle away from New Edo once more, or even try to conquer a barony for your very own.
Sindri waved away Kane's words impatiently.
You make me sound like some kind of sadistic little boy.
If the diaper fits...
Rage glittered in Sindri's blue eyes, but he managed to keep his temper in check.
Assuming I live through the trip, how do I convince the you in the past that the you in the future sent me back? How can I effect a change or keep the you of 27 years ago from killing me on the spot?
I've got that covered.
Kane moved toward the door.
I've had years to think about this. Wait here and I'll show you.
Send Tanvira in here to keep me company.
You two wouldn't have anything to talk about. She's a little out of your league.
But not yours? I can tell her about the time I tricked you into helping me steal the Aurora spy plane. That might impress her.
Kane ignored him. He stepped out into the corridor, wondering, as he knew he would, if he hadn't made a grievous error in retrieving Sindri. As brilliant as the little man was, he was also as untrustworthy as he was ingenious, as his parting shot about the Aurora reminded Kane. However, he could only hope that Sindri would swallow down his ego-fueled hatred and make common cause with him. He went to his quarters, the same ones he had been assigned by Lakesh nearly 30 years before. They hadn't changed much, except for the computer terminal and desk he'd brought in some years ago. He sat in front of it, making sure the little vidcam was connected. From a padded sleeve envelope, he withdrew a small compact disc and inserted it into the port. He touched the drop-down window's play option. Pixels sparkled on the monitor screen, and a head-and-shoulders image of himself appeared, appearing to stare into his own eyes.
I've just gotten back from Thunder Isle. I already turned the data cards over to Bry, and we'll be making the retrieval attempt shortly. Before we do, I need to locate Tanvira, because I don't trust her to be out of my sight when we power up the dissociator.
Kane stopped the play and fast-forwarded the CD until the screen glowed blue and blank. After making the proper adjustments with the vidcam, a real-time image of his head and shoulders appeared on the computer's monitor screen. He used the mouse to click the record icon.
It worked. Sindri came through alive and whole and apparently as nasty as when you last saw him. I've already briefed him on what Bry and I hope to accomplish by injecting him into your time period. He's agreed to it. But then I haven't given him many options.
He paused to smile, but he knew it would look forced.
I hope this works. But if it does, I won't know it. I won't be here to think about it. But if it does work, do me and yourself a favor, even though you won't like hearing this. The next time you're alone with Bridget, stop acting like an idiot and tell her how you...
A distant sound, like a wet paper bag bursting, suddenly echoed down the passageway and into his quarters. Kane paused the recording, his nape hair tingling. The noise was vaguely familiar, but he couldn't immediately identify it. Pieces of the redoubt's roof still came down occasionally, so he attributed it to that at first. He listened for a count of five for another sound. When one was not forthcoming, Kane ejected the CD, slipped it into the padded sleeve envelope, and went out into the corridor. The fact that the sound was not repeated did not comfort him. He experienced the opposite emotion, so he hurried on to the operations center, carrying the CD. Even as he entered the central control complex, Kane sensed something was terribly wrong. Quietly, his flesh crawling at the oppressive silence that filled the room, he went forward through the big, vault-walled room and into the anteroom, breathing shallowly. Bri lay sprawled face down on the floor underneath the dissociator's control console, blood oozing in a dark pool around his head. His wheelchair was pushed into a corner, canted up on its left wheel. Above the chair, smeared on the wall, was spread a great slurry of blood and brain matter amid a scattering of bone chips. Heart trip-hammering within his chest, Kane knelt beside Bri, pressing his fingers against the side of his neck as he did so, knowing in advance he was wasting the effort. Only a moist, pulsing cavity occupied the back of Bri's skull, and he recognized the kind of weapon that had made the ghastly wound. From the way the blood was still spreading, and had yet to begin to congeal, he knew whatever had happened hadn't been that long ago, perhaps only a matter of a minute. Suddenly, he sensed a presence in the room, and he came to his feet in a rush. Tanvira stepped out from behind the Mat-Trans unit.
He tried to stop me. I didn't want to kill him.
Gripped in her slender right hand was a pistol that looked as if it were made from brushed aluminum. It held the general configuration of a revolver, but instead of a cylinder, a small round ammo drum fit into the place where there was normally a trigger guard. There wasn't a trigger, just a curving switch inset into the grip. The barrel was unusually long, nearly 10 inches in length. A unit of energy inside the grip moved a piston that propelled the explosive projectile made of tungsten carbide. The handgun had been in use on the Manetius moon base, part of the materiel salvaged from there and stored in the armory. It possessed almost no recoil to speak of. Kane didn't raise his hands, noting Tanvira had put her bodysuit back on even though the front still gaped open.
He tried to stop you from doing what?
Tanvira patted the pocket of her garment and Kane heard faint clicks.
I have the data cards. I'm taking them with me.
To where?
To High River first, then to my brother, to Sam. I'm sorry I must do this, but I can't allow you to send Sindri back in time.
Actually, Sam can't allow it. He's controlling you, don't you realize that?
Her knuckles whitened on the firing switch as she gestured with the pistol's long barrel.
I don't want to have to kill you too. You were a great man once. Now, remove the dissociator's power cables from the gateway. I can reset it myself.
I'm sure you can. Your old man taught you well.
No more talk. Just do it. Or I'll kill you and do it myself.
Kane shuffled forward, surreptitiously placing the CD on the console on his way to the elevated gateway platform. He began unscrewing the coaxial couplings from their sleeve sockets. Tanvira watched him alertly. He removed them in silence, not even looking at the woman.
Tanvira, I doubt you'll believe me, but I'm not crazy.
I know you're not. Just selfish beyond belief. You want what you want, and to hell with the rest of humanity.
Kane worked a length of cable loose and straightened with a heavy sigh. He used his foot to close up the cover plate.
Tanvira, if I could only...
He gave the cable a jerk and whiplashed it across the intervening yards between him and the dark-haired girl. He had accurately gauged the length he would need. The metal-collared end of the cable struck the back of her right hand with a loud, meaty impact.
Ow!
Tanvira's fingers opened and the pistol clattered to the floor at her feet. She stumbled backward, nursing her injured hand. Kane bounded forward to scoop up the pistol, but her leg flashed up, the foot catching him solidly on the jaw and knocking him backward. He would have fallen if he hadn't grabbed the edge of the console. Kane was shaken by the force of the kick, half stunned. The salty tang of blood filled his mouth as Tanvira went into a series of graceful sliding dance-type steps. She moved her arms and hands in intricate motions, and her expression became one of calm, mask-like beauty. Kane pushed himself away from the console, recognizing the fluid, formal grace of the movements. A fragmented memory of the Scorpia Prime's sinuous dance flitted through his mind. A cold, sick anger filled him, and recklessly he bounded toward her. Tanvira whirled on the ball of one foot, the other sprang up and out and glanced off Kane's right ribs. Despite the protection offered by his shadow suit, the axe-inflicted wound flared with a burst of agony. Clutching at himself, he backed away. He found Tanvira's expression of serene detachment chilling. Her dark eyes were wide and seemed to give off a luminous, malignant light. She almost appeared to be in an altered state of consciousness. With her squid implants, that was a very real possibility. Kane realized that Tanvira was as determined to kill him as any opponent he'd ever met, and she was probably a good deal more capable than a lot of them. He moved toward her, kicking his right leg in a long arc, intending to catch her on the chin with the toe of his boot. Almost negligently, yet with blinding speed, Tanvira shifted laterally to the left. Kane did his best to shadow her fluid movements, filling the air around her with a flurry of closed-fist karate blows. The punches she couldn't duck or dodge, she blocked, her arms as graceful and swift as snakes, but feeling as hard-muscled as oak. Angry and frustrated, Kane put all of his upper body strength into an uppercut. His fist missed the underside of her jaw by a fraction as Tanvira's body abruptly doubled like an eel. She bent backward at the waist, her spine seeming to be as flexible as rubber. She somersaulted backward a good 4 feet and turned to snatch up the pistol. She was in the process of firing it when Kane leaped forward and stab-kicked at her hand. His foot struck the long barrel and wrenched it from her fingers. The explosive tungsten carbide pellet crashed into the generator with a whomp of impact and a shower of white sparks. A cloud of greasy black smoke belled out and up. Even as the pistol hit the floor, Tanvira was lunging to the counterattack. Kane shunted aside a crescent kick, but couldn't fend off the edge of the flattened hand slashing into the side of his neck. Pain streaked up and down his spine like needles of fire, and the room grew blurred at the edges. Fighting unconsciousness, he staggered to the right, shifted position in a feint, and then reached for her. His hands closed on empty air as Tanvira danced gracefully out of reach, kicking with her left leg at his kneecap as she retreated. Her timing was a shade off, allowing Kane to sidestep and latch onto her ankle. He pulled upward, intending to dump her onto her back. To his astonishment, Tanvira sprang into the air as he pulled, almost as if she and Kane were partners practicing an acrobatic trick. Holding her body almost perfectly perpendicular to his, she hugged herself and pirouetted clockwise in midair, twisting out of Kane's grip. At the same instant, she used the torque of her spin to kick with her right foot, the heel catching Kane in the chest and driving him backward against the console. She performed a somersault and came up on both feet, facing him. At that point, kneading his sternum and gasping for air, Kane realized he had better not take any more chances with Tanvira. She was one of the most skilled and deadly opponents he'd ever faced in unarmed combat, or at least he couldn't think of anyone with superior abilities at the moment. Tanvira sidled toward the gateway chamber, and Kane moved to cut her off. He launched a roundhouse kick in the same split second she did. The calves of their legs collided, but since he was stronger, he knocked her off balance. She stumbled, but didn't fall. By the time she recovered her footing, he was inside her defenses. As he clutched a handful of her bodysuit, she tried to jack her knee into his groin, but he managed to turn aside, so the blow landed on his thigh. Kane closed both hands around her shoulders, intending to outmuscle her, since he knew he had the advantage in strength. She knew it too. Teeth bared, Tanvira tried to butt him under the chin with the crown of her head, but Kane contorted his body, avoiding the blow. He wrestled her around and applied a full Nelson, bearing down, trying to force her to her knees. Tanvira bunched the muscles in her legs and sprang upward, planting the soles of her feet against the armaglass walls of the Mattrans chamber and kicking rearward. Both of them stumbled backward, and Kane felt his grip loosen. In the split second it required for him to bear down with the full Nelson again, Tanvira flung her arms straight up over her head, relaxed, bent her knees, wriggled her hips, and slipped down between his arms. Kane knew what her next maneuver would be, but his mind and his reflexes didn't work in tandem. As he expected, Tanvira knocked his legs out from under him with a scything arm sweep. Kane fell heavily, the rear of his head striking the edge of the console. Even as he heard the crack of bone hitting metal, little multicolored pinwheels exploded behind his eyes. Kane wasn't aware of losing consciousness completely. He had a vague recollection of falling, then a sound like a gale force wind was filling his head. He levered himself up by his elbows and squinted at the bright flares bursting on the other side of the armor glass walls. The hurricane howl climbed in pitch as the device cycled through its dematerialization process. Then the electronic wail from the jump chamber faded, dropping down into silence. The bursts of energy behind the brown-hued translucent slabs disappeared. Clamping his jaws on a groan, Kane slowly dragged himself to his feet. The back of his head hurt abominably. He touched it and felt a lump, but his fingers came away dry. He glanced toward Bry's corpse.
Shit.
Sindri chose that instant to stroll in. He glanced around the smoky, gore-soaked room without a flicker of emotion.
She was out of whose league again?
While Kane tended to Bry's body, Sindri sauntered around the Mattrans unit, pursing and unpursing his lips in thought. The slit pockets of his shadow suit were too shallow to allow him to put his hands in them, so he clasped his hands behind his back.
Where is this High River place she told you she was going?
He nudged the elevated platform with a foot. Kane rolled Bry over, dragging him away from the pool of dark blood. The wound on his forehead was small, but the pellet had broken through the skull bone as if it were old plaster. Bry's eyes were partially open, and even through the blood masking his face, Kane saw a slight smile touching his lips. It was a smile of peace.
Colorado, on the site where Cobaltville used to be.
Sindri nodded and stepped up onto the platform, jiggling the wedge-shaped door handle of the unit.
I presume some security measures would have been taken to keep us from pursuing her via the Mattrans.
With thumb and forefinger, Kane closed Bry's eyes.
I would imagine so. But even if there weren't, if we followed her through, we'd be gating into a nest of blasters. Soldiers would be waiting for us.
Sindri cast him an annoyed look over his shoulder.
So your whole plan is screwed, right? You can't send me back without those data cards.
Kane stood.
Not through the dissociator, no.
The dilator?
No, it's inoperable.
Then what?
I'll explain later. Give me a hand with Bry's body.
I'm not an undertaker.
Kane stared at him in silence for a couple of seconds. Then he crossed the room in two swift strides. Sindri saw the look on his face and tried to jump down from the platform, but Kane caught him. He latched his hands around Sindri's neck and heaved him from the floor, slamming his back against an armor-glass slab. He held him at eye level.
You'll by God need an undertaker if you don't do as I say. I'm not in the mood for your above-it-all horseshit, pissant.
Sindri's feet kicked impotently as he clutched at Kane's wrists and glared at him with pure, unadulterated azure fury.
You don't dare kill me, Mr. Kane. You need me to bring Bry back to life, to bring back all your friends to life. Ah!
Kane pressed his thumbs against Sindri's larynx.
I won't kill you, but there's nothing in the manual that says you can't travel through time with dislocated arms and legs and even a skull fracture. Do you understand me?
I understand.
Kane relaxed the pressure around the little man's neck and lowered him to the floor rather than drop him. Picking up the CD from the top of the console and pocketing it, he turned toward the door.
Come with me.